Track session number 20303, Reel 4.
John Goddard, Reel 4.
After the submarine dives at 9 o'clock off the Isle of Wight, she then was due to proceed through the Portland exercise areas and send a surface signal at 8 o'clock the following morning, close to Portland. The signal was never sent. And 1 hour later, the naval submarine disaster routine was put into operation and a submiss signal was sent to all ships in the English Channel area about the affray being overdue. This then led to ships being alerted they might be required to go to sea. After 3 more hours, the signal sub smash was sent. I was in HMS Dolphin with the other 11 sailors who had been left behind. We were finishing up our breakfast, and the first we knew was at about 8:45, the sick bay was opposite where our dining hall. From the sick bay, hand carts were being brought out, loaded up with medical supplies, and being rushed down to the submarines on the jetty. And it was then a sailor passed through the mess, and we said, "What's all the excitement?" He said, "Oh," he said, "there's a submiss message out, the affray. She hadn't surfaced." It was about 10 minutes after we were all sent for by the commander of HMS Dolphin. We reported to his office and he said the affray hasn't surfaced. He said, "There are newsmen pouring down from London." He said, "Your leave is stopped. You are not to go ashore." He said, "Now," he said, "you've got to see the master at arms and you've got to send a telegram to your next of kin." And the telegram was to read, "Safe, did not sail with affray." We did this, and then for the rest of the day, we listened to the news broadcast about the affray not surfacing. She hadn't surfaced that night, and about 7 o'clock at night, we were sent for again by the duty officer and told that those of us 12 behind could go ashore if we wished, but we weren't to speak to the press. The following day, the affray still hadn't been found, and the search was centred off Portland, and by now about 30 ships were in search and aircraft, and they gradually widened the area. Come Wednesday, the affray hadn't been found, and by now things were looking desperate. 24 hours later, all hope was given up. So that meant 75 men had been lost. The search was then scaled down, and a force of frigates was set up then to search the English Channel to locate the affray. They searched for 3 months, and then the affray was finally located by the Isle of Alderney in a underwater trench called the Herd Deep. And they sent divers down who could identify, and they also, although nobody knew at the time, had an underwater television that had been developed, and television photographs were shown in the press. So it was now known where the affray was. She was sitting on the seabed upright, and the only visible sign of damage was the snort mast was lying on the seabed close by her. The snort mast being a pipe that normally lays flat along the casing, but can be elevated 90 degrees so it comes up level with the tops of the periscopes. And there's a valve on the top, not unlike a lavatory valve, that water goes, air can come down the pipe, one half of the pipe, and it can be used to run in the engines, the diesel engines, and then the other half of the pipe, the exhaust comes up. And the valve at the top, should the submarine dip below the surface of the sea, it works like a lavatory valve and shuts off and stops water going in. Well, this snort master snapped off at the bottom, and that's what the Admiralty released. In the meantime, 6 weeks after the loss of the Affray, a board of inquiry was held in Portsmouth, and the 12 of us left behind were required to attend as witnesses. It was headed by an admiral. There had been two captains there and several commanders. And the questions were, when you joined the submarine, and what was your job on the submarine, usual things. But then the questions were asked by the president of the board, the admiral, and he then asked the question, what did the captain of the submarine say to you before she sailed? Now, what it told us was that when the cruise with the 25 officers were over, our program was unclear. He said they had found trouble with number one battery tank, and we might be coming back to have it repaired, or we might be going on a courtesy visit to Liverpool and then coming back. And the thing about it was, when he asked this question, was you could tell the other officers sort of just paid that more attention to what you were going to say. You could sense that it was a vital piece of information. And then he continued asking various other things. Then, well, from my point of view, I just became a redundant sailor. I went back into the pool and I got drafted to another submarine. But rather interestingly, within 4 months, the 12 of us that were left behind, we were all separated and drafted to other flotillas, either abroad or around the British Isles. In my case, I was sent to Malta to join the submarine. We were all split up.
And your feelings now about Affray after this length of time?
Well, what happened was the results of the Board of Inquiry in October of that year, the First Lord of the Admiralty announced in Parliament that the Board of Inquiry had drawn two conclusions. There had either been a battery explosion or the snort master snapped off, possibly due to a collision with the ship. And that was the result of the Board of Inquiry. Then there was an immediate 40-year cabinet secret embargo on all records relating to the Affray. And for 40 years, the Navy falsified what was said. For 40 years, anybody raising a question, what happened to the Affray, was told by the naval spokesman, said that the accident was due to a broken snort mast, and there's no reason to think of anything different. Well, that was a lie, because the Board of Inquiry said there were two possible causes, and the Navy just dropped the idea of a battery explosion. Now, when you think about it, half of the crew had never been to sea on that submarine before. The submarine had been in dock for 4 months. When you commission a submarine, after a refit like that, you crew joins it, and then you what's called work up the submarine. You go to sea, you dive, you run all the equipment, and then you have breakdown drills. The hydroplanes might fail, and you have to work them by hand. You practice fire drills. You practice engine breakdowns. And you also work yourself up into a team. and you'd work yourself up into a fighting team. And to that submarine, to go to sea, with no work, with half a crew had never been on before, with no workup having been done, with overcrowded with 25 extra officers who had never served on a submarine, with four raw Marines who were just completely unfamiliar, completely in a strange circumstance, it's quite obvious that something could have gone wrong. Also, on submarines, when you're charging your batteries, you get a certain amount of gas given off, and you can't smoke. And in fact, the duty electrician goes along what puts no smoking board on through the submarine, charging, no smoking. So who's to say that because of the combination now of gas and fuel oil fumes, that there wasn't a battery explosion? If there was a battery explosion, the pressure hull of the submarine would have contained it and would have spread along the submarine. The submarine, people in the control room would be knocked unconscious or killed. The submarine would have sunk to the bottom. When it hit the bottom, the pipe, it just stands up freestanding on the casing, just on a bearing that it swivels on. That could have been snapped off and fallen over. But the Navy only said it was due to the snort mast snapping off. And nobody could say anything further than that for 40 years. Now, there's been a development since then. Last year, in July, I was contacted by the BBC, who said they were making a radio documentary, 2.5-hour programmes, on Radio 4 about the loss of the Afrey. The producer came down and interviewed me as part of these two programs. And for the first time, when it was broadcast, at the end of September 1999 and at the beginning of October, the truth is starting to come out. They interviewed the wife of the first lieutenant, who said the husband came home petrified. He just didn't want to go to sea. He said the submarine was unfit to sea. One of the artificers had been writing letters to his father, who at the 6 months after were actually published in the newspaper called The People, where he'd been writing to his father saying the submarine wasn't fit to go to sea. Well, they actually, BBC interviewed his sister. His father had died, and she had the letters, and she read out the broadcast. In the second broadcast, it's related how the producer and I met at the public records office at Kew, and he got what few records had been released into the public records office, and we sat down to read them, and when it came to my evidence, what did the captain say about the program after they'd finished their training cruise with the officers? We found out that my evidence had been falsified. The actual official documents have been falsified. Well, what it is, I was asked, and I'm reading from a newspaper article here that was published at the time. Records at the Public Records Office in Kew, London, show that Mr. Goddard was asked by the board sitting in Portsmouth whether his commanding officer told him about any problems. His reply is recorded as, "No, sir. I cannot recall any." The ball's next question follows, "Is that the only trouble you knew of?" Now, between being asked, did I know of any troubles, I had actually said to the board, "Yes, sir. There was oil leaking in number one battery tank." That had been eliminated from the record, but the records hadn't been amended for the next question. And that is why we found his reply comes, the board's next question is that the only trouble you knew of? And his reply came back, "Yes, sir." So this is where they falsified the records. And it's in black and white. And the BBC and the producer and I actually found it. And we were actually talking live, as I am now, when we found it. And now, it's aroused a lot of interest because the truth is coming out, how the Navy has tried to cover up for 60 years now, how it killed 75 of its own men, And I've since had a phone call from the producer to say that it's now planned that a television documentary will be made about it. More than likely, it's going to be Carlton TV. They're going to do a TV documentary. So more of the truth about the affray and the Navy cover-up will be coming out.
Anything else to add about the affray?
Well, it's just that when you go through something like that, obviously, you know, you try to push it in the back of your mind because you've got to carry on, haven't you? And so there you are. It just sort of happened. But when you get older, you dwell on things. And the other leading seaman, TD2, the one who I beat to get on board and took up the torpedoman's job, and leading seaman Smith, he had to go to sea on her. You know, I often think about that. Just fortunate to be here. But of course, this is what happens, isn't it?
Now, you said that you got this other submarine in Malta.
Yes, yeah, so I then went out to Malta, and I joined a submarine called the Tabard out there. Well, this was quite interesting, because at the time, the South Africans had a small navy, about three frigates, and we kept a cruiser and two frigates on the South African station. They were based at Simonstown, and it was decided to give submarine exercises to the squadron down there, South African squadron and armed or naval squadron. They should send a submarine down there. So that was interesting. We took a trip down to Durban, and we exercised from Durban, and then we set sail, and then we went across to Trincomalee, which, Ceylon as it was then, absolutely beautiful island, and Trincomalee was a marvellous place. And there we exercised with the East Indies fleet and also the Indian and Pakistan navies. That was a very interesting trip.
What were they like to have contact with?
They were very, very good. In fact, I mean, you talk to an Indian sailor or a Pakistani sailor. I mean, most of them went to college. You know, they were very highly educated, just even the ordinary sailors. Yes. Yes, they were very good. And of course, also very pro-British as well.
Were you happy in Tabard?
Yes, Tabard, yes. It was a nice submarine. Mm. Then we came back to the Mediterranean. Now, this was part of a 2.5-year commission. So that was 1952. And we did lots of exercise, of course, because NATO exercises were going on all the time. But we had some nice trips to different countries. And then 1953 was in the middle of this 2.5-year commission. But it was rather fortunate because the coronation came along. And for the naval review at Spithead, it was decided to bring home the Mediterranean fleet, to join the home fleet for the naval review. So that was a bonus because we came home to England for 3 weeks. And we were given a week's leave each watch. And then the final week, we were in dockyard sprucing up the submarine and then took her out for 3 days into position for the review. Then the review took place. Marvellous firework display that evening. And then next morning we all sailed to our respective stations. Following year, I mean, the rest of the year was pretty routine exercises and foreign visits around the Mediterranean. And then the following year, I came home. Now, this was now 1954. Had my foreign service leave. This was rather fortunate. When I came home, I had about 6 weeks' leave. And they used to have Admiralty Fleet orders in those days, advertising different things. And for seating stewards at Wimbledon in those days, they used to advertise for servicemen or servicewomen who were willing to give up some of their leave to be a seating steward at Wimbledon. And so I saw this as soon as I got home. And Wimbledon weren't going to be for about another 6 weeks or something like that. So I applied, and I was a petty, I'd be passed for petty officer then and become a petty officer. And anyway, for 2 weeks of my foreign service leave, when I got home, I was a seating steward at Wimbledon. And being a petty officer, in other words, a non-commissioned officer, I was, you've got these gangways all the way around. You find two servicemen at each, or servicewomen at each, probably about two dozen of them, I think, where you come in at the top and go down to your seat. And I was on the one where the Royal Box was, which was rather nice, because it meant you had all the VIPs, which made it all very interesting. Yes. Also, what was very good was, in that particular block, was where they had the newsreel cameras. Didn't have many TV cameras, probably because there was only BBC One. And on the first day we were there, if I remember, I think it was Vexatious. It opened. It was all the reigning champion that opened. Anyway, it was Vexatious or something that bloody opened the tournament. And a lot of VIPs and seats. And the cameras were in this second tier, or two tiers, in fact. All the seats had been removed. All the cameras were there. Next day, when we went to Manhub position, there were no cameras there at all, because it was just the ordinary matches. And tennis followers are absolute fanatics. They will give it, they will kill their mother to get a ticket. And there was another petty officer, Nye, manning these arms. Gangway and inspecting people's tickets. And then people came up to us, any chance of getting in? You know. And of course, those empty spaces were there. They had to sit down on the cement slab, no seat. So we let a couple of chaps in. And the next thing is, they tipped us £2. And so we thought, well, this is a good thing. And so we got all these tips, these fellas in. Come 5 o'clock, when the officers and workers are turning out, you get absolutely inundated with people coming round saying, any chance of getting in? Of course, a lot of them are attractive young ladies. And so we then said, oh yeah, somebody really nice. Oh, you can go in, love. But then, of course, you found you let a fella in. He gave you a quid. I mean, this is the days we were on about £2 a week or something like that. And so, after the first, well, second day, young ladies had had it. Yes. And as I remember it, the final that year, of course, I saw every match on the centre court for a fortnight, and I believe it was Drobny and Trabert were in the final.
So this was 54?
This was 54.
And then?
Well, in 1954, I then decided, right, I would leave submarines, right, and that, then I more or less left the following year, and I did one or two courses, and then, in 1956, the Navy had a big change, because there'd been a lot of trouble in the Navy. Over long-serving engagements, people didn't like it, and they were voting with their feet. And when they'd finished their 12 years, or their 5 years, they were just leaving in droves, weren't signing on for pensions, and that means the Navy was losing experienced people. Because they couldn't leave the Navy, sailors were trying to get out the hard way. Some were feigning illnesses. Some were even feigning suicide. Some were claiming to be communists. And a lot were resorting to sabotage. There was bolts put in engine gearing, sand put in machinery. And on some ships, this phenomenon crept in of a phantom ditcher. People really just wanting a hit at the Navy would throw things overboard. It could be a tompion of a gun. It could be an oldest lamp. And in fact, one ship I was on, it was actually the ship's bell was thrown over. And all these activities taking place. Also, the Navy didn't recognise married families. There were no married quarters. And, you know, to get compassionate leave for any reason, because your family was practically impossible in the Navy, they just didn't recognise it. And this again, just with calling people to leave. Also, the leave, the pay was abysmal. Also, 2.5 years, sailors just weren't willing to put up with going abroad to the Far East, the Mediterranean, for 2.5 years. The separation of it all. And so the Navy decided they had to make changes. And Duncan Sands was the Minister of Defence. And he, Navy pay was practically doubled. The other forces as well, of course. Married quarters were introduced. And the time spent abroad was shortened. So a lot of changes came in. And also, they changed the officer structure. Now, most officers were trained at Dartmouth. And they were even having trouble recruiting officers because they wanted a higher quality of officer in the Navy. They really wanted people who had been to university. And which meant they had to offer them a good career structure. And to do this, they decided that if you join the Navy as a Dartmouth cadet, you had a 1 in 3 chance of reaching the rank of commander. That was the way the promotion pyramid was going to work. At the time, it was about a 1 in 5. So it wasn't a very good career structure. But to fill the base of the pyramid, it was decided to commission more sailors, or sailors from the lower deck. Right. By then, 56, I was 28, and I was coming up 2 years to finish my engagement. Now, the awful predicament you had, I was a petty officer. In 2 years' time, I would have served 14 years in the Navy. If I decided to leave, that meant 14 years I'd accrued to pension, I would just throw away. And if I stayed in the Navy for another 10 years, I would get a pension. So I decided to stay in. But because of these changes in the Navy structure, I thought to myself, right, I will stay in and endeavour to qualify for a commission. I'd received several recommendations, and so this is what I decided to do. Well, the Suez Canal incident took place in 1956. The following year, I joined a ship called the Loch Ruthven, a frigate. And we went to the Persian Gulf. And in fact, we were the first Navy ship to go through the Suez Canal after it was cleared, after the Suez War. It's a U, Ruthven. And we were out in the Persian Gulf for a year. Now, in the Persian Gulf, there was literally nothing to do. We were based at Bahrain, an Arab island. Of course, Arab way of life, totally different to ours. No alcohol ashore, for example, not the normal shops, not the normal cafes. There was a naval compound, and there was a battalion of army soldiers in this compound. And literally, our recreation, we made ourselves. It was mainly swimming, sailing, playing hockey ashore, these sort of activities. And we used to patrol the Oman coast, because at the time there was an uprising going on in the Oman, and it was all connected with oil having been discovered in northern Oman. And we ended up with the situation with the American oil company based in Saudi Arabia fighting British Petroleum by proxy, and the rebels against the Sultan of Oman were backed by the Americans at the end of the day,